thank you for all of your hard work. My name is Wendy, and I serve the village as an education associate, and I'm really excited to introduce Jerry Krakow and his wife Jan, who is their first time here in the village. And Jerry has over 20 years in the Forest Service, and he's going to talk to us about National Parks today.
National Park Service,
serving our... so he's here to share some of his expertise. Thank you for coming from Albuquerque and visiting us here.
It's good to be here, and it's good to speak to a group of hardworking folks just off the line of duties and responsibilities.
You betcha.
So.
Hope you can't tell we haven't had our showers yet.
Yeah. Well, if it gets oppressive, I think Wendy will chase us out. Say, go to the shower houses.
So. I might be the stinky.
My topic, I've sort of chunked up into three sessions, one today, one on Thursday afternoon, one Friday afternoon. And the ostensible reason that I was invited, besides being a retiree from the National Park Service, is that this is the 100th anniversary of the agency called the National Park Service. The agency does not predate the parks. The parks came first. And then came the agency. Some years ago, after I retired, I volunteered in Yellowstone a couple summers, and my assignment was at a museum that was used by a small detachment of soldiers on the banks of the Gibbon River at the Norris Geyser Basin. If any of you have been to Yellowstone, you may know where that's located. And the station, the Army station, was put there because the Park Service was unable to, the Yellowstone staff was not able to manage the park. People were walking off, poaching game, breaking off formations that were deposits and so on. And so the Army was sent to patrol the park, basically. That illustrates the need for a staff that could be overall managers of the National Park Service. And so the centennial, which is actually a week after next, the 25th of August, came well after the first of the national parks. But in order to run up, this logo is probably the one that you may be more familiar with. I did not bring my flat hat along. That's another symbol, I guess, of the National Park Service. The flat hat, that of course is tied to the U.S. Army. If you look at National Park uniforms and you sort it out, you'll kind of go back to the U.S. Army. The U.S. Army was patrolling the parks when there wasn't enough staffing. In order to kind of develop the chronology of why an agency celebrating an anniversary, I think one needs to look at the idea of why set aside land in the first place for present and future generations. That's the idea, and it's one of the things that I think makes America great, and I believe America is still great. And nevertheless, it's an important aspect of what this nation is about. And the idea of setting aside land as a park stimulated many nations around the world who did not have such a concept of their own. And they borrowed, as we have borrowed from many other nations over the centuries, ideas that are incorporated into our system of government and so on. The whole idea, though, of the logo, which was developed in the 1920s in a little park in Oregon Caves in southwest Oregon, had a graphics person that was interested in developing a logo, and that arrowhead becomes a symbol then of the agency. But in Wendy's introduction, not to criticize her, but the blending together of federal agencies is very, very common. And so there's not much difference between the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, the National Park Service, the Bureau of Land Management, and the U.S. Forest Service. It all is kind of blended together. It's just that we, with our nose out in front, look down our nose and say, our culture is the National Park Service or the Forest Service, or you know how agencies are. It's a bit like Holden Village comparing itself to some other Lutheran camp elsewhere in the United States. Of course, Holden is the greatest, and therefore that's the viewpoint that you have. But in terms of setting aside land, I asked Wendy if she would show a brief YouTube, this kind of a hello overview, about 5 minutes long, to kind of get you into thinking of the national parks. And you'll see several images, I think, that you'll recognize as this video plays.
Can we turn the lights on the screen off?
You can turn the lights off.
I joined the service because I believe in the mission, because I want to see this land preserved. As far as you can see, this is the homeland of our people.
I think we have to be worried about the future of anything that really takes a strong vigilance to protect.
I think it is a travesty that the National Park Service ever considers itself a land management agency. It is an agency that manages ideas and ideals.
We tell the stories of American people. We tell the stories of the tribal people. We tell the stories of all the people.
And there's something about wilderness that modern man needs.
It's just a great mission. I love the idea of protecting, you know, that natural world.
Through picturesque North Gate, we enter Yellowstone National Park. Since the beginning of time, nature has carried on a never-ending creation of fantastic wonders in Yellowstone National Park.
Keep this one great wonder of nature as it is.
There are special places that need to be preserved.
Keep it for your children and your children's children.
The defining moment is clearly the establishment of Yellowstone National Park in 1872.
And for all who come after us as the one great site that every American should see.
The park idea is it's beneficial to a society to set aside large tracts of natural land.
As we'll leave them unimpaired for future generations.
There had been the beginnings of a historic preservation movement in this country, and this was part of the expansion of the Park Service.
Nothing can replace the feel of a historic site.
The artifacts are documents. They tell us something about ourselves, how we live, what's important to us.
The lady is beautiful. She's a symbol of freedom in America.
Give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to be free.
They're our future generation. They're the ones that's going to be helping to preserve these sites in times to come.
The United States became the United States right here.
It's rather a moving experience to actually see where it all happened.
The presidency was born.
If all men are created equal, why can't we work to the very center, the very core of what it means to be an American?
Going to a monument and understanding the history and the sacrifice that went into the reason that monument's there.
Yellowstone National Park.
as I would not be a slave, so I would not be a master. This expresses my idea of democracy.
Historic places have power because they're real, because they're authentic.
In summer of 1941, a date which will live in infamy.
When I came to the wall and touched that wall, I felt my friends in there. I know they're here in spirit.
Each national park is a story, and the stories have meaning for American people. There's not a lot that binds us all together. One of the things that does are these parks.
And I'm not worried about the future of the Park Service as an agency as much as I am about the parks.
One of the wonderful things about the National Park idea is that it's never done. Work's never finished.
This map, so you can have a look at it. Right now in the United States, there are right at 415 National Park Service units of the National Park Service. A unit is a status that is authorized by Congress. In other words, there's typically a study done of a park area to see if it meets the criteria to bring it into the system of national parks. And so 415 units of the National Park Service. I brought along a guide. Because we're in the state of Washington, you are well aware of several, but let me just read some national park areas in Washington. Eby's Landing, Fort Vancouver, Klondike Gold Rush, which is in Seattle and also up in Alaska. Lake Chelan National Recreation Area, Lake Roosevelt National Recreation Area, Lewis and Clark National Historical Park, the Manhattan Project, which is down in the Tri-City area, and just as a brand new one. That includes Los Alamos Labs in New Mexico and the Redstone in Alabama. Minidoka National Historic Site, which is Japanese relocation camp on Bainbridge Island. Mount Rainier, of course, Nez Perce National Historical Park. North Cascades National Park, we're right at the foot of the North Cascades, and Olympic. So it's a passive of parks in the state of Washington. We don't have visitors. I would like to, in my introductory remarks, extend my thanks to Holden and the staff here for inviting me to participate in this week that we happen to be here. It's a marvelous place and most enjoyable, and though we haven't sampled a lot of it, my wife had been here way last century. So she had sampled it sometime before. What I played off of in my title, calling this America's Best Idea, many of you recognize that line from from Ken Burns and David Duncan's PBS series. They borrowed it from a writer, Wallace Stegner, who taught creative writing at Stanford and the University of Utah. But a little further investigation, it turns out that an ambassador to the United States from Great Britain used that phrase in 1912. That phrase, many of us use. I use it not in tribute to Dayton Duncan or Ken Burns, of course, but just the whole notion that it's something we exported to other nations. As to where did this all begin, I mentioned in my hello the other day the idea that one might need to consider that we human beings, if you read Genesis and other parts of the Bible, are to have dominion over, and that's been translated too literally, I think, that we're in charge. And like you recently experienced here at Holden Village, nature is in charge. And though this notion of having dominion is one that played out in many ways in the history of this nation, it's an important idea that kind of blends into the notion of why set aside land in the first place. One of those almost religious ideas that, irrespective of world religions, is the notion that the people of this land were destined to spread their superior civilization across the whole nation. Do you remember that term, manifest destiny?
Yes.
That idea that somehow they blended it in to say, God ordained this. God ordained that we should spread our superior civilization to the Pacific coast. And that drove many Americans westward. And as a result, they were utilizing natural resources throughout the nation. But the starting over again is an idea that Americans had played on time after time after time. If you were a farmer in the Carolinas, you might move like the Scotch-Irish did into the bluegrass of Kentucky and then to Missouri and on west. And if you wore out a farm, so what? There was more land to be farmed elsewhere. The old joke was that a farmer wore out three farms and five wives in the course of his lifetime by continuing to move. This abundance of land just seemed critical to the way that the nation expanded. And the notion that land was fertile if it would grow trees. Some of you may know something of the physiography of the Midwest, like Western Indiana, Illinois, Minnesota, Iowa, Eastern Nebraska, Eastern Kansas. Parts of that physiography is the long grass prairie. And when first settlers moved into that area, they were suspicious because it didn't grow trees. There was all this grass. And they didn't really believe that it would grow grain, for example, corn or wheat or that sort of thing. And they deliberately went about clearing land of trees so that they could grub out the stumps and till it. And then somebody developed the idea that maybe that grass could be turned over. And one of those people was named John Deere. He invented a plow that was made of metal instead of wood. And you could cut the roots of that prairie grass, that long grass prairie that might hide a man on horseback, it was so tall, and turn it over and then begin to disc and develop it into farmland. The John Deere was soon quickly emulated by many other implement inventors, and the plow became one that does an image that you may have heard of, the plow that broke the plains, which is one of the things that in American history you hear a variety of lines. Well, as the nation spread on westward and the land was cleared or plowed under, and the dark black soils, especially of Iowa and southern Minnesota, were just amazingly fertile. You could grow what became first the wheat belt, then the wheat belt moved west and the corn belt developed, the corn belt as we would know it today. And as a result of this spreading westward, there was the notion that there was value in land that could be enjoyed in what we today might call a form of recreation. But it had to have ideas developed coming out of an industrial age where Americans were working hard like you've been doing today, only your day might be 10 or 12 hours long and your week maybe 6 days a week. And there wasn't much pleasuring to be had in the course of that, unless, for example, you were able to maybe take an excursion train out of Chicago to kind of a recreation area that you might call a beer garden, depends on what ethnic background you are of. But you might go for the day, family, a picnic, to a beer garden, and then you would ride the train back into the city at the end of the day. Well, more and more literature was being written by writers like Thoreau and Emerson and others that depicted nature as worthy of enjoyment, not just for its own sake, and not something to be exploited like in farming or minerals being mined or what have you. And that literature kind of kept the idea alive that came to be one of setting aside land. A number of painters and artists, particularly painting in a group of painters called the Hudson River School, Thomas Moran and Albert Bierstadt among them, painted these grand big canvases, as big as this screen or larger, that had a romantic view of nature. And usually down in a corner was a diminutive figure of a human or two to give a little perspective, but the human was just overwhelmed with this beauty. That's part of the coming age of this nation. We often look to Western Europe, and we wanted to be recognized worldwide like Western European nations, or what you and I might have taken in a high school or college course called Western Civilization, or an introduction to Western civilization. The idea is that there ought to be something that we can hold up as grand and magnificent about our nation. And the capturing on canvas of scenes from the Rocky Mountains, for example, that Moran and Bierstadt did coming out of the Hudson River School of Painters back east, kind of captured the idea of the grandness of nature. And in other words, you could look at the trees, and there weren't trolls under all the bridges. Red Riding Hood, Little Red Riding Hood, was not going to be eaten by the wolves all the time in this nation. And so you begin to evolve toward an idea of enjoying the out-of-doors or pleasuring out-of-doors. The idea kind of came about as we became much more nationalistic. We have things to brag about internationally. was the idea in the late 1900s and the early 20th century. We could call attention to the beauty of our temples in nature as opposed to temples that recognize world religions elsewhere, or cathedrals of Western Europe or elsewhere that demonstrated the ability of nations to build these magnificent edifices. The upshot of it all was captured by a historian at the University of Wisconsin named Frederick Jackson Turner, who posited an idea that this receding area of free land developed our democracy. That's been pretty much debunked by historians over the years, but it was a powerful nationalistic view of this land that you could increase democracy because there was an area of land on the edge of what he called the frontier, and his theory was called the frontier thesis. That idea is one that kind of carried forward to setting aside land. And though Yellowstone is often accorded recognition, justifiably so, as the first national park, it might surprise you to know that the first reserve set aside was in Hot Springs, Arkansas in 1832. Bathhouse Row at Hot Springs, which is a national park, was set aside because that's where those who worked hard all day, you could probably use a bathhouse right now. not the bath, but the mineral waters, the warm or hot mineral waters that would relax you, cleanse your spirit and your body at the same time, would be of importance. And so in 1832, Hot Springs was set aside. Now, it didn't become a national park until 1921, but it was set aside in Arkansas as a reserve for the public to use. Later, individuals like John Muir, who dropped out of the University of Wisconsin to engage in what he called the University of Nature, went to California. And in San Francisco, he asked a number of people how he could get to the wild of California. He knew something of the Sierra Nevada, and he was guided to a place that became Yosemite in the High Sierra. And Yosemite was set aside by California in 1864 as a reserve, kind of like the Hot Springs in Arkansas were set aside. Muir, who had this notion of what came to be called preservation, setting aside land should be used, but he had an arch enemy by the name of Gifford Pinchot. I'm not going to test you later, so you don't need to remember that name. But Pinchot was named the first director of an agency called the National Forest Service. And the Forest Service was closely tied to a university called Yale. And they developed a major called forestry. And you took a few courses in the sciences, maybe a humanities course or two, soil ecology, and whatever. And you could develop an individualized major. And Gifford Pinchot was the first to hold a baccalaureate degree with a major in forestry. When he got out of Yale, he did look for employment in the United States, but he went to Germany because the Germans had developed what you and I would call today tree farms. In other words, it's possible to plant trees, harvest them, plant another crop, and just keep perpetuating the forests of Germany. They were renowned for that in Europe, and Pinchot went there to study it. And he coined a term when he came back to the United States, and Teddy Roosevelt appointed him head of the Forest Service. The term is conservation. There wasn't a word in our language called conservation until Pinchot developed that word. Now you have kind of the polarity set up. John Muir saying we ought to preserve this and set aside and not use it. And Pinchot arguing for conservation, which is conserve but use. Now, those of you who are familiar with public land agencies know that there are agencies that practice what's called wise use. And that is if there are mineral deposits or forests or grazing land, for example, that's managed by the Forest Service or the Bureau of Land Management, then those resources should be developed and used. And so Pinchot and Muir butted heads a lot. It all came to a head out in California when San Francisco needed more water. Now, living in the Southwest, water is critical. I'm astonished by the amount of water here in the Northwest. I knew that. But coming from Wenatchee to Chelan a few days ago, along the east side of the Columbia River, seeing all of the orchards and the abundance of the Garden of Eden along that stretch made me realize the importance of water in a more direct way than previously. So San Francisco's need for water, they found a mountain valley in the Sierra next to Yosemite National Park, and they built a dam across it that's called Hetch Hetchy. And Hetch Hetchy dammed the Sierra Valley, made it into a reservoir, which obscured, of course, the beauty of that landscape forever. And then San Francisco had a supply of water. That happens over and over and over again, and you can come up to last month or the month before that in the West and find that same thing being played out. Muir, in trying to defend and protect the Hetch Hetchy Valley, along with a couple of other individuals in San Francisco, formed something called the Sierra Club. And the Sierra Club promoted the idea of preservation, which was the mantra that Pinchot used, and the one that, that Muir used and Pinchot was opposed to. Pinchot would have been for water development in that Hetch Hetchy Valley. So you begin to see some setting aside of land with hot springs, Yosemite, the loss of the valley of Hetch Hetchy in the Sierra. And that brings us to 1872. And that's the date when Congress acted and set aside a large portion of Northwest Wyoming and called it Yellowstone National Park. That really is the first park that's nationwide. Some of you may know that story. It's one that perhaps you have some thoughts about. I've been rattling on here, and I want to encourage you, if you have questions or want to raise a point, please jump in at any time. I don't mind you doing that. I don't want to control the flow. Obviously, Yellowstone, in the Romantic view, sort of has the notion that it was set aside because some males gathered around a campfire. Have you heard that story? They gathered around a campfire in Yellowstone and said, "We ought to set this aside for future generations." That's a rather romantic view. Now, let me offer an antidote to that. The Northern Pacific Railroad liked to haul freight, and the Northern Pacific made money by hauling passengers. And they put two and two together and concluded that you could bring the passengers from the Midwest on the Northern Pacific as far as Livingston, Montana, put them on a stagecoach and take them to this public grounds called Yellowstone. And there they could have their pleasure in the out of doors. In other words, this economic push for setting aside land may have been more powerful than that romantic notion of around the campfire a group of people decided, well, set this aside. So Yellowstone's established in 1872 as the first national park. So the difference between 1872 and 1916 is the difference between the first park and the establishment of an agency called the National Park Service, the centennial of which is this year. At this point, do you have any questions or comments of some things that I've quickly passed across? Yes.
Thank you for telling me who Gifford Pinchot is. I live very near Gifford Pinchot National Forest.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. Sure.
Yeah.
There's abundance of stories about Pinchot. He and Teddy Roosevelt were very good friends. They did, sometimes as friends, they batted heads. And there's a great story about Roosevelt wanting to establish more national forests, and he could do it by executive order. Something that Obama's been criticized of doing, but every president has done it. They've used the historic preservation to set aside land. And consequently, those who argue that that's not democratic forget that it was Congress who enabled the President of the United States to have the executive order power. And so that set aside of national forests that President Roosevelt was doing, he cleared out a large room in the White House, took all the furniture out, put maps on the floor of the western half of the United States. And the story is that he and Gifford Pinchot crawled around on their hands and knees with pencils and drew boundaries of where they wanted this or that national forest to be located. And with the executive order that he had, Roosevelt was able to set aside land. Well, it's a great image to think about Teddy crawling around on his hands and knees declaring, let's make a national park here in national forest in northern Idaho. Or how about one in the Cascades of northern Washington or wherever. That imagery you see being carried out time and again by all the presidents of the United States, not clearing furniture out of a room, but using the executive order to set aside land as a public land. Any other comments or questions at this point that you might have?
Can you speak to the difference between a national monument and a national park?
Okay. The question that was asked is, what's the difference between a national monument and a national park? What the Park Service is engaged in, and you can't read it on this screen very well, is labeling groups of parks that are similar, like historic sites, for example, like Nez Perce National Historic Site. It has couple of three locations, one in the Wallowas of northeastern Oregon, a couple in Idaho. They're usually smaller, but not always. They're usually smaller, and their focus may be on a particular event in history. A national park, the original idea, and what I think most people think about, is that you're going to manage nature in a very expansive area of thousands upon thousands of acres of land that might include scenery like forests, mountains, streams, prairies, what have you. And as the years have rolled along, the American public has pushed the Congress toward more land set aside for recreation. And so there's not just the national parks, but a national monument might be, like in western North Dakota, Teddy Roosevelt National Monument. And that's a small national park in the badlands of western North Dakota. Those badlands are being eaten away by that terrific oil boom of the Bakken Formation in western North Dakota now. Then there's matters like Lake Chelan. Let's make it a recreation area and let's call it a national recreation area. But then there's one up north called Ross. There's one called Lake Mead down in the southwest near Las Vegas. Their mission is more of a focus toward outdoor use of the kind that may be water related, like the reservoirs. But it might include components like camping and hiking and that sort of thing. There are national seashores. Maybe you've been to a national seashore, like Point Reyes on the coast of California, or Gateway in New York City, a national seashore, or on the coast of Maryland, there's a national seashore.
Assateague?
What? Assateague, yes, thank you. I couldn't come up with that, but the nomenclature clusters a group of like mission set-asides of land that help define what it is. And so they're all, however, administered by the National Park Service. It's just that we've gotten into that nasty business of alphabet soup. Today we live with acronyms, and that's kind of how I see all of these park units. There's the national park, but there's a national historic site. There's a national historical park. It's bigger than a historic site. One of them is called Cumberland Gap, where the passageway into the bluegrass of Kentucky was used by tens of thousands of settlers from the Carolinas going into the bluegrass and beyond. Cumberland Gap was the fastest way to get to the Ohio country. You went down the Great Valley of Virginia through Cumberland Gap and then back northwest to get to Ohio. Today we'd say, well, why don't they just go on a straight line? Well, if you ever walked across the Appalachians east to west or west to east, you know, it wasn't an easy thing to do. So that's kind of a long-winded answer to your question about nomenclature, but it's one that we get caught up in. Yes.
Are you at some time in your series going to discuss the funding issues facing the national parks?
I thought I would do a little section later this week on problems facing the National Park Service right now. That's one of them.
Great.
The backlog of maintenance is the code words that you hear about throughout the press that looks at the roads that have been allowed to deteriorate, the campgrounds, the picnic gazebos, the buildings that house a museum or a visitor center or whatever. That's one of the big problems. And as a teaser, there's another problem that I'll toss out and talk a little bit more about later this week, and that is who's going to support the national parks in the future? All of us in this room are, it appears, white Anglo-Saxon Protestant. What's happening to the population in the United States now as it moves increasingly toward a population of color? And if you go to national parks, who do you see but people like that look like you? Mm-hmm. You don't find many Hispanics or African Americans utilizing national parks. If you see Asians, they tend to come from Japan and China to large national parks like Yosemite or Grand Canyon or Bryce Canyon or Zion National Park in southern Utah. That's one of our problems too, is the National Park Service needs to be a park service of all the people. You look at the employees of the National Park Service, they look a lot like you and me. There aren't many who are employees of color. So you have a lot of problems that kind of revolve around that whole issue that bears some talking about. Mm-hmm. other comments or questions?
Go
ahead.
I was going to ask you about the large wilderness area in Idaho. I believe it's the largest in the lower 48, and I forget what it's called, but if you know anything about that, I believe it's named after a senator or something, but it's a large wilderness area that takes up a good bit of Idaho, if you know what I'm talking about.
What?
In the Panhandle or down
below? No, it's near the Sawtooth. It's just north of the Sawtooth Range, kind of in the lower Panhandle, if you could call it that.
Frank Church.
Yeah, Frank Church. Thank
you. Oh, it takes two lines.
That's the member of the Senate that it was named for. I kept thinking Bob Marshall, but that's in Montana. There's one right north of Holden here called the Stephen Mather. In North Cascades National Park. Mather comes later because he's the first director of the National Park Service. And so that's the wilderness area near here is named.
In the chat, did we turn the lights on?
I think.
Are there more slides?
Yeah, that's fine to turn the lights on. And anyway, if you want to diminish that map, you can do that too. I think that the wilderness area that you speak of in Idaho may not be as large as some of the wilderness areas in Alaska.
Yeah.
And so, as to its size, it's one that often is considered to be used just for a few exclusive backpackers and hikers and so on. That's one of the points of contention, I think, in setting aside wilderness. Those who want to develop the resources can't do that in the wilderness, as you know. You can't take an ATV into a wilderness area, for example.
Thank God.
You can't use a mechanical post hole digger in a wilderness area. It has to be muscle power, I guess. Your muscle power.
Thank you.
That sort of thing. But I think it's important for us psychologically to know that there's a place like you identify. That we may never go there, but to know that there is such a place is important to the human psyche, I think. And that's the value of the wilderness areas that can be set aside in a national park, but also in a national forest, in a Bureau of Land Management managed piece of land. I don't think any fish and wildlife reserves have wilderness areas, so the first three are the ones that more often are the ones that manage the wilderness areas. Other questions? There's someone over here that I didn't...
I'm up here.
Oh.
I was wondering if there are different rules of use between a national monument, a wilderness area, national park. You know, sometimes there's campgrounds, sometimes there's commercial things allowed to operate. Is there a set of a homogenous, I guess, set of rules for those things?
I think I can answer that. Did you all hear her question from on high? All right. The difference is that the rules are different for a wilderness area than a national park, a national monument, or a national recreation area.
Okay.
Those are the two differences. A wilderness area is restricted in terms of how you can access it, not motorized use, for example.
Okay.
And campgrounds are typically primitive campgrounds. It's what you carry in, as opposed to my hooking on to my camping trailer and pulling it. I couldn't go into a wilderness area. Probably there's no developed roads that would handle my rig, but there may be forest roads that you could walk on. But that's the only fundamental difference that I see between a wilderness area and a national park area.
Okay.
Other questions? right here. Yes.
And maybe this will, I'm curious if you're going to, on your perspective on, or if you're going to cover it later, you know, there's a lot of talk about, you know, we should take these big federal parks and put them into state hands.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a real hot button topic in the western states. Mm-hmm. And maybe it's hottest in a state called Utah. Mm-hmm. The Utah legislature and the commissioners of counties in southern Utah want to kick out the federal agencies managing land in Utah and take over managing the land by the state. And it all has to do with this, in my judgment.
Yeah, sure.
It has to do with there's resources out there that we should be developing.
Yes.
We could make money on it. Mm-hmm. But, you know, Jan and I lived in Salt Lake City for 9 years. And I know from our experience that when there was a new national monument created called Grand Staircase Escalante in southern Utah, the county commissioners were terribly upset and still are. If they need a whipping boy to get public opinion wound up, they'll use it. But they haven't denied the money coming in from tourism that has visited Grand Staircase Escalante. It offsets in a greater way than what the natural resources might have supported. I've read about two law school reviews about the Utah legislature passing legislation that would take away public land and give it to the state of Utah. First of all, it's not possible under the U.S. Constitution, according to the brief. And the second thing is that Utah wouldn't have enough money to even begin to manage it compared to what is managed now. But what occurred in the state to the south of us at Mount Huron a few months ago is another example of that same question that you raised. And that is, should we be able to force our way into a Fish and Wildlife office and take control of it because we don't like the way they make decisions? Is that as American as apple pie? I don't think it is. Not especially if you subscribe to the rule of law in this nation. Yes.
Well, I appreciate your reference to motivation because I think that's where we have to look, not whether the feds can do a better job than states, et cetera, but to look at the motivation. And my examples would be two state parks in the county where I live, here in Washington State. The state turned them over. One was turned over to the local city. It's on the border with Canada, and so the city took that park over. And the other was turned over to the Colville Tribes. And in both instances, those parks were greatly improved by being locally run. So I just wanted to say, we have to look at motivation, not whether one entity is better equipped than the other.
That's a good counterpoint to my generalization, I think, to say that they have become better managed. I think as a general rule, that wouldn't be the case, but I guess if you looked at it on a case-by-case basis, as you're saying, then your thinking may be revised, that locals could manage it better. That's something I think that movement is going to continue on, whether it slows any or gets diverted onto other things, I'm not sure. The fall election may have some play on that.
You think
We don't know. We don't know what either of the candidates would do. We can predict, but it's prediction, and it's fraught with all kinds of problems, I think, to do that. Other comments or questions at this stage? Yes. So
what capacity did you serve the National Park Service in?
Say that again.
What capacity did you serve the National Park Service in?
I was a historian for the National Park Service.
Cool.
I was a park historian in Missouri, a park called Ozark National Scenic Riverways. And then I worked summer times guiding tours way back last century at places like Fort Laramie National Historic Site in Wyoming, Pea Ridge, a Civil War battlefield in Arkansas, Fort Matanzas, which is near St. Augustine, Florida, and part of the Castillo de San Marcos star-shaped fort that the Spaniards built there in the 1600s. And then I worked out of Denver for 11 years for parks all over the country. So my work had to do with doing historical research and writing, but then it also engaged in my passion, which is historic trails. And so I mapped the Trail of Tears for the Cherokee removal to Oklahoma in the 1830s. I mapped the Santa Fe Trail, which was a commerce and trade route between central Missouri, Boonville, and Old Franklin, Missouri. So you know about that, through the Kansas City area and then on to Santa Fe, New Mexico. And then I ended up being superintendent of historic trails for the National Park Service for a dozen years. And one of those trails is called the Oregon Trail. Another one is called the California Trail, which is Gold Rush. So those are not long, skinny parks. You can only touch them where there's access. Mm-hmm. If it's privately owned, the landowner determines whether you can get on the land. Mm-hmm. In other words, it's not like the Pacific Crest Trail, which is an end-to-end hiking route, like the recent movie depicted. So a historic trail is kind of dotted along where you might touch it. Yes?
How long do people try to walk the Oregon Trail? How long does it take?
About 4 months, and yes, they have. And some of them use conveniences. Maybe they have a support vehicle like the group of bicyclists might have, mm-hmm. a sag wagon, in other words. Or there's others who have used a covered wagon and traipsed across the whole trail. But you can't always get on the trail. You might be on a county road close to it or nearby, not totally on. Yeah. And pack animals, I know the individuals that use pack animals on the trail. There was a book on the bestseller list a couple years ago by a man named Rinker Buck, B-U-C-K, a journalist out of New York, who with his brother took a covered wagon across the Oregon Trail. Buck was, he's a good writer and the book was a bestseller. But he didn't have many public relations skills.
Oh.
And so he trespassed on public lands. And I know ranchers in Wyoming are mad as hell about it still. Because he basically thumbed his nose at them in his book. It wasn't enough to trespass, but then to be critical of them in your book. I guess that's the power of buying ink by the barrel. I don't know.
Are there still historians in the National Park Service? It's a current position that's funded.
Yes.
Yippee. I'm glad to hear.
The whole National Park Service has been downsized. Mm-hmm. One of the things that I regret, having come through the ranks, is that we couldn't exist as an agency if we didn't have volunteers. It used to be that we had employees that worked the information desks and led the tours and did a variety of things. That cachet of the National Park Ranger was very important, I think, as a public relations tool. Now we depend upon volunteers, and thank God for volunteers. They have many of the same skills and abilities, and fortunately, they're able to carry out responsibilities that formerly was done by paid employees. So it's kind of funny for an old codger like me to go into a park and see what it used to be like, you can predict, or a rare occurrence, you might see an actual ranger at an information disc. We're leading a tour. That's kind of a rare occurrence in my experience anymore, unfortunately.
There's lots of danger rangers.
Yes.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Other comments? We're out of time. I'm sorry to hold you longer than you intended, you working folks. It's time to elevate your legs and get out of these hard to sit in chairs.